So, welcome to the 126th episode of the Open Science Radio. And this time we have a guest, and I warmly welcome John Tennant. Hi, John.
Hi.
And of course, with me is Conrad.
Hi there.
Ah, luckily. I don't forget you this time.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Ah, shame on me. Anyway, we have one of those guys with us with whom it's really difficult to actually find a proper introduction. So I'll just leave it and hand it over to you, John. Would you give us a proper introduction of you and maybe a bit of your background?
Sure. So hi, everyone. Thanks for joining in. So I don't really know what to call myself anymore. Either. I work on quite a variety of things, and it's difficult just to apply one label. But like now, just for fun, I like to call myself like a rogue researcher. So I went independent from anything really at the end of 2017. And yeah, you know, the idea of being a rogue is kind of cool, plus nerdy if you're like online gaming too. But like my history is that I did a PhD in paleontology. That was at Imperial College back in the old days. And then I moved to Berlin to become the communications director of a tech startup here called Science Open. And that's how we all met. And now I work on just a range of projects in my, daily activities. And it ranges from anything to do like freelance journalism to writing kids' books about dinosaurs to trying to overthrow scholarly publishers. So it's a nice variety of things these days.
Yeah, and I think this will be now our hard job, actually bring all this together and trying to bring this in the right order. People will find you definitely at your blog, Green Tea and Velociraptors, so which shows you a little bit of the background that you have. But as you mentioned before, there are a lot of activities that you have, and actually it will be tough for us putting all this together now. But maybe let's start with something you started a while ago. This is basically the PLOS Paleo community. Maybe you can tell a little bit about that effort.
Yeah, so the PLOS Paleo community is just, it's three of us. We're all paleontologists by background, and what we do is we essentially just write articles about paleontology, about things like open access, really whatever we fancy. We're all quite open researchers. And we just happen to do that under the banner of PLOS. They have quite a few of these different communities. And really, it's just about, online social engagement, really. So we get to write about whatever we want. We have full autonomy. We get to solicit guest posts from other members of the community. And it's sort of just like an online space where paleontologists can come together and learn about new things and write about things which they're passionate about. And that's it, really. It doesn't take up too much time. And it's nice to, sort of be under the banner of PLOS. So PLOS are one of the top open access publishers out there. And yeah, we're pretty happy that they, in exchange for, researchers doing a lot of the work for them, they give something a little bit back to the community as a sort of hat tip. So
you have a good overview about a lot of communities. The paleologists, how open are they in general? Is this basically really conservative, or are they far ahead of other communities? What is your estimate regarding this in general?
Ooh, that's a very good question. So for paleontologists in particular, so I feel like in many ways the global paleontology community has been very much ahead of the curve when it comes to lots of open things. So we have sort of like a universal acceptance now that things like open access and open data are good. And there are lots of research articles about this. We also have an online portal called the Paleobiology Database, which has been around now for more than a decade. And this contains essentially so much data that about the fossil record, like almost every piece of data ever collected about the fossil record is there, and openly licensed in this this easily accessible database. And it has like an API and all the usual bits and bobs that you'd associate with like an open database, and has provided the basis for really accelerating research in our field forward. And that's been fantastic. As well as that, like we've seen paleontologists sort of increasingly adopting like the use of new publishing outlets. So, for example, you know, Nature have their own sort of open access mega journals, and then we have PeerJM Plus One. And what I think we're seeing these days is paleontologists are tending to publish a lot more of like what you might consider like the higher impact research, or like the research which might have more of a broader public interest tends to go into these open access outlets these days. So I think, yeah, in many ways, we're very much ahead of the curve. But in others, we're perhaps lacking a little bit. So while this this ongoing preprint revolution is happening in the biosciences, you know, I run a paleontology-themed preprint server too, and the uptake for that has generally been quite slow. I'm not entirely sure why that is, what the reasons against it are. In fact, you know, most of the reasons why people have said that they don't want to use preprints are actually, you know, reasons why they should use preprints more often than not. And yeah, so it's variable. You know, open science and openness is a very, very complex, multidimensional space, and it makes perfect sense for different communities to adopt different strands of those as they see fit. One thing which I'm doing at the moment as well is analyzing, you know, how open are core paleontology journals. So, you know, there are a lot of still, you know, apart from these open access mega journals, there are a lot of journals which are dedicated purely to paleontological research rather than being multidisciplinary. And my preliminary analysis of like the proportion of open access in those journals are that it is sort of embarrassingly low. So we're maybe looking at around 10% of open access articles in the last 2 years for on average for each of these paleo-themed journals, which is about 25% of the global average across different disciplines at the moment. So yeah, swings and roundabouts at the moment. Things are going well in some areas, perhaps not so well in others. But overall, I would say that the global paleo community is you know, it's really coming together and doing some nice work in terms of openness.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned this before that you have this preprint server paleo archive. Maybe you can dive a little bit into this. I mean, you said it started slowly, or the adaptation is rather slow. Have you directly compared it to BioArchive and their history? And maybe what was the starting point for you to do that, actually, to make this happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, PaleoArchive it's not unique in any way. But like, yeah, if I compare it to, so in fact, the motivation of it came from looking at BioArchive and PeerJ preprints. And these were the outlets that paleontologists had been using before to share their work. But the rate of growth was incredibly slow. So, you know, these platforms were getting significant funding, but paleontologists were only submitting 1, 2, 3 manuscripts there like a month. And the way I looked at it was because, you know, paleontology is a very unique discipline, and we have a very, you know, unique set of norms and practices and requirements, I guess, for publication. So I was like, these things I felt were absent from venues like BioArchive and PeerJ preprints. So what I did was I worked with many members of the paleontology community. It was like, you know, what would the intrinsic sort of capabilities of a platform be to encourage you to use preprints, or, you know, self-archiving and all of this sort of thing? And that led to specifics around issues to do with like taxonomy and the naming of species. And yeah, so we developed like this sort of like these community specific set of guidelines for what a preprint server should be like. And then the Open Science Framework provided the infrastructure in order to do so. So they have now about 25 different branded preprint platforms for specific communities. And PaleoArchive was, I think, among like the first wave of them. And yeah, it was fantastic. So, you know, there was a lot of engagement from the, so I called it a platform by the community for the community, and the steering committee comprises 7 paleontologists from all around the world working in different aspects of paleo. But yeah, the adoption was actually relatively slow. Like, you know, I engaged the paleo community as like, you know, what is it that you would want specifically to encourage you to adopt preprints and other self-archiving practices? And, you know, it was like, we need X, Y, and Z. So we built them X, Y, and Z. And then they were like, well, you know, we can't wait for other people to use it. It's been almost a year now since we launched, and we've published 82 manuscripts so far, which is significantly more than BioArchive and PRJ Preprints have during the same time interval. But, you know, realistically, we could have hit thousands by now. If you look at other servers which launched around the same time, the growth has been much faster. In other cases, it's been much slower. And honestly, I'm not entirely sure what the resistance is. I sense there's a lot of stubbornness. I sense a lot of people still don't see the point. Others might not understand, you know, what the platform is for. In which case, it's a communications failure on my side rather than like an information failure on the user side. But yeah, you know, these things are slow. You know, it takes a long time to create cultural change, and I'm happy with the rate of growth so far. But you know, I'm ambitious. I always want things to go faster and to achieve more.
I guess persistent is the important part here, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. So yeah, I mean, like one of the communications methods which I use. So I send out dozens and dozens of emails every week to authors of newly published papers, specifically those which are paywalled, and I explain to them very clearly how they can essentially make their work open access for free using PaleoArchive. I explain the journal policies to them. You know, every email is unique to these authors. And yeah, I send out dozens of these every week saying, hey, did you know that, for example, if you use PaleoArchive to self-archive your work, it's risk-free, it's financially free for you, and you can get more readership and more citations for your work, in theory. And on average, maybe I get 2% of responses to those emails, you know, despite it being everything which in theory a researcher should want and could need. And of those 2% of emails, maybe only 1% or so actually go forward and commit to actually sharing something without breaching copyright in some way. So it's a very unusual sort of communication experience for me. So.
Do you figure there's any way to maybe not reach those who have already or who already have published individual articles, but maybe to reach that audience who's about to somehow or someone publish an article?
Oof. Well, that would require me knowing in advance like where people were going to publish, and that's invisible, isn't it? So I'm not sure. In that case, it would have to come from the individual sort of user side, where they'd have to be aware that PaleoArchive was an option for them, or just preprints in general, really. So, you know, I'm less interested in seeing the growth of PaleoArchive than I am in seeing the growth of preprints in general. So, you know, if PaleoArchive caved, but instead all paleontologists started using BioArchive instead, I would still consider that an achievement overall.
Yeah, true.
But in terms of engaging people so that they were more aware of these services available to them in advance, you know, that just requires persistence again, like you said, you know, making sure that the message gets out there at conferences, across social media, across mailing lists, through different research institutes. And it's a slow diffusion, really. So
I think, I mean, back when PRJ started their preprint service, basically, I think what they did quite cleverly was to also try to reach out the undergraduate community. Mm. And because they have been, or amongst those who will actually continue their academic career, amongst those, they will have quite a standing because they already early on tried to reach them, and they will probably remember, there's PRJ offering this preprint server. Mm-hmm. So I think that would have been one of the first communication strategies that I might have looked into, whether I can somehow reach that undergraduate or graduate community somehow. And that's probably through the faculties at universities, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how easily the communication with faculty directors is or what they're standing towards open science and open access is. Did you ever try to reach somebody or get back to, for example, the Imperial College and your contacts over there?
Yeah, so I know for a fact that all of the researchers at Imperial College are very much aware of this service. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, most faculty around Western Europe are also aware, you know, through various communication strategies, like through conferences and things like that. Hmm. But I'm not sure awareness really is the problem in a lot of cases. I think there's still a lot of inherent resistance to preprints from the community. And I think there are many reasons for this. So, for example, there are a lot of very senior researchers in the field who have been very vocally anti-preprints in the past, and in particular have used a communication angle that it will be detrimental to research careers through doing so. Mm. That has a very high impact because, essentially, if junior researchers are under the impression that preprints will have negative consequences on their career, then rather than positive, which is more the reality, then yes, you can see where the resistance comes from there. Mm. You know, so while they might be more eager to adopt the practices and, you know, understand the fundamentals of it more, it's that concept of risk, I feel, which comes through most strongly. So most of the time when I speak one-on-one to researchers, to younger researchers in particular, I say, hey, look, have you considered doing this? They're like, yeah, but, you know, my supervisor says not to. Mm-hmm. And it's because, you know, it doesn't have this authoritative stamp of being peer-reviewed. It doesn't have the stamp of the journal brand for some proxy of legitimacy or quality, and therefore is seen as being, you know, I guess in many ways, fake news or bad science or something, or just, you know, an unnecessary part of the publication process. So there are a lot of barriers to overcome there. And I feel like risk is one of the greatest ones. Just getting people to simply try it is difficult in many of these ways. It doesn't matter if they're right or wrong as well. It's like the risk factor. You know, I'm still very junior. And, you know, if there's like an online conflict between me and senior researcher X, and people are watching that, it doesn't matter if I'm right or wrong. If they take an anti-preprint stance, then others must follow that because, you know, the way power dynamics work within research communities.
Mm-hmm. How is it, by the way, regarding the journals? Do they have policy regarding preprints already? I know this, at least from, let's say, biology, many journals have already endorsed that and agree that things that are published on preprint servers are, can be still submitted there. How is it in the paleo community?
So it's a very mixed bag again. So one of the things I did before launching Paleo Archive was I actually did a bit of research, or not research, I did some, you know, web analysis, and I created a database of the 220 odd journals in which paleontologists publish, and looked at what their preprint and self-archiving policies were, the overall open access policies were. And I created a public database of this, which comes in very useful. So a lot of the time, paleontology journals are still published by like the major publishers like Taylor and Francis and Elsevier and Wiley. And they have sort of universal self-archiving or preprint policies, in which case, you know, it's the same as every other field. And for a lot of like the smaller community-led journals or those which are from learning societies or, you know, just generally smaller branded journals, they often didn't have preprint or open access policies at all. And I contacted the editors of about 100 of these journals and said, hey, you know, could you clarify what your preprint policy is for me? And often they were like, they either, again, didn't respond, they didn't understand, they were actively hostile towards the idea, or they said they would have to, you know, run it through their committees and all of this stuff. And, but yeah, for about 100 of these journals where there were no clear policies, they often, for the majority, didn't seem to have any interest in adopting a preprint policy at all. So ironically, no matter how much we dislike these larger legacy publishers, often they're actually the most progressive in terms of you know, these sorts of policies. And I'm not sure why that is. It's probably because, you know, they have an increased interest in like mandates and control over these sorts of processes. But yeah, you know, I still have this online database that anyone can go in and consult and see like what the preprint policies are. I think for the majority of, 98% of those who do have a preprint policy say that it's totally okay. So, yeah. And that includes all, you know, the vast majority of the most important journals, I guess, in the field. So, you know, there's no resistance coming from that side, publisher side of things, more often than not. Mm-hmm.
So looks like there's still a long way to go in respect to preprints in that community. So kind of what is modeled or needed are kind of role models that are going this direction. And well, luckily we have somebody sitting here who's really also working this direction. So you are also involved in the Mozilla Open Leadership cohort or project. Maybe you can explain a little bit what's happening there.
Oh, goodness. Okay, so that was years ago now, I should say. So, oh, goodness. When was that? It was like back in 2000 and... Well, I was living in Berlin. So, living about 2015, I think. So, yeah, Mozilla launched this this open leadership program where research individual researchers and people interested in open culture and that sort of thing, open government, open society, open data, open research, could come together and, you know, learn about open principles and then use those to then go on and mentor people engaged in new open related projects. I haven't done that in a while now, but I think they're in their sixth round at the moment for the Mozilla Open Leadership Mentorship Program. So, you know, if anyone listening is interested, I think you can submit yourself either as a potential mentor or if you have a project which you think could do with some mentorship to help improve it, then definitely check that out. Yeah, for me, it was an interesting experience back in the day. So, you know, it was one of the first times we sort of had any sort of formal training in the sort of open space. And the Mozilla team were just absolutely phenomenal in sort of like empowering you both through knowledge and confidence and skills to transfer those onto to wider communities. And it was a really great experience back in the day.
So it was more or less a kind of a training program that you have a couple of scheduled trainings on a variety of topics, or was it more one-to-one working with a mentor?
So there were two parts. So like the initial training program, it happened in Berlin, actually, which is, you know, why I was fortunate enough to be part of it. And that was teaching you things like how to use things like GitHub for open project management. But once we'd gone through like that initial personal training stage, you know, we ended up helping mentoring like a range of projects, so all of these open leaders. And I was fortunate enough to work with a really talented researcher from Canada, and she was looking at liberating, I think, funding opportunities and stuff all around Canada for various sort of open related projects. And she built this incredible application just as like a side project to her work. And all that involved from my end was just calling up every week or so and just making sure that she was on track and learning new things. But yeah, she was flipping amazing. So, you know, my role as a mentor was more just to sit back and go, my goodness, you're doing some incredible things. So yeah, it was fantastic. It was a great experience still. So.
And it, I guess it's important to perform these kind of teaching others in that sense, that you kind of, well, make them role models and show that they are not alone, right? And this is maybe the most important thing, that you're not the lonely scientist trying to change the system, but there are many others that are trying to go in the same direction.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, I mean, you both know this exceptionally well. So, you know, the global open community is one of the most brilliant and welcoming communities like I've ever been part of. You know, I have so many good friends now around the world in this space who are working on fantastic things and really becoming like leaderships within their own research leaders within their own communities, and really to make a difference. And it's brilliant to watch the growth of people through time as well within this arena, and, you know, see the amazing things which they're working on. But yeah, I think at the first OpenCon back in 2013 now, at the end of it, it said, Heather Joseph from Spark, she said, you know, the open community now is less of a community and more of just like a big global family. And I think that's true.
It feels definitely very warm and welcome. And whenever you go to these kind of meetings, you say, okay, finally normal people, right? So,
normally not.
Yeah. But you mentioned before, you're kind of the rogue scientist now, and we want to dig a little bit in the past again. And you and Martin Eve. Actually, we stumbled recently about Martin Eve in a different episode regarding something else, actually. But you and Martin, I think, Stuart Lawson, you together also, well, officially battled Elsevier RealX on one level. Maybe we can dive into this history or a piece of history a little bit.
Yeah, maybe we can. So I'm just going to assume that everybody who's listening to this, you know, anyone who's tuning into the Open Science Radio is probably not the biggest fan of Elsevier, so we don't need to dig into that. But yeah, so back in 2016, now I think it was led primarily by Martin Eve, who is a phenomenal researcher, profoundly aware of the issues in scholarly publishing and everything. He basically wrote this this referral to the UK Office for Fair Trading Standards for Elsevier for market level for disrupting the market, basically, or there not being a functioning market around scholarly journals, which, you know, Elsevier were basically creating dysfunction through. And we submitted that to the Office for Fair Trading Standards back a couple of years ago now. But sadly, we didn't get a response for whatever reason. Maybe the evidence wasn't good enough, which we presented. Maybe it was because the Office for Fair Trading Standards didn't care. Maybe it was because Elsevier have basically a lot of the UK government within their pockets. you know, who knows? Who knows why? But yeah, it was interesting. So, you know, the rationale for that was that essentially Elsevier have become too powerful as a scholarly publisher, and they essentially do have like this insane control over the publishing market, particularly in you know, Western Europe. Well, in fact, you know, around the world, and they've achieved that through some profoundly anti-competitive practices, such as having, you know, these non-disclosure agreements on all licensing contracts to different universities, saying that they're not allowed to share information with each other about the pricing for the different journal bundles. And if you think about it, it's just an outrageous thing to do. It's like saying that you can never share information on the price, because if all of the different universities had that information, then they would be able to negotiate better and drive down the prices. Whereas what else they want to do is keep it secret so they can drive up the prices indiscriminately as they feel, because that's how they generate the 37% profit margins. It's anti-democratic, it's a tax on public education, it's corruption at its finest, and yeah, we reported them for it. But we didn't get a response, sadly.
Interestingly enough, Ross Mounts did something very similar recently. He reported Elsevier to the Advertising Standards Authority because he basically is accused, the right word, he blamed them for giving very intransparent pricings on one of their leaflets. And surprisingly, the Advertising Standards Authority at least upheld his complaint and responded to him that they will, that they have checked this, and they basically agree with him, and they have contacted Elsevier. I think from now on only it only can go down. But yeah. Well, it is at least first a positive sign, right?
Yeah, it's positive for like many reasons. So, you know, I think the issue here was that Elsevier were advertising on their website and on various other, you know, promotional materials that the APCs for their journals were anywhere between 150 and 5,000 euros or dollars or something.
Dollars, yeah.
Whereas in reality, they have journals which exceeded those boundaries, and therefore it was essentially fake advertising.
Yeah.
So, you know, the UK Markets Authority or Advertising Standards Authority were, in this case, very correct to penalise them for it. We don't know what the impact of that is going to be.
Yeah.
The incorrect information is still there on Elsevier's websites, so they clearly haven't changed that yet, because we all know how difficult it is to edit a website. But, like, it was powerful for many reasons, because it showed that, you know, Elsevier are not immune to these sorts of regulations, which they, you know, they can be punished in some ways for their misbehavior. But also it showed just like the value that reaching out as an individual member can really do. Like, you know, Ross, all he had to do was just be somebody who wanted to achieve something, And he did. And it's going to be for the betterment of all of scholarly communication at the end, just because he took that extra little step and, you know, he empowered himself to try and make a difference. And, you know, hopefully now he did. Yeah. So hopefully it will be an inspiration to others to say, hey, look, you know, actually I'm not happy with how this thing works either. Maybe I can speak out about it and do something too. Yeah.
On the other hand, it showed something very obvious, I think, that is rather negative, because coming from this, from the authority where the complaint was filed, it is the Advertising Standards Authority. So what they can basically do is, punish Elsevier for stating false advertisements, right? Your complaint, if I remember correctly, has been filed with the Competition and Markets Authority. Mm-hmm. So it was filed at a place that would be much more harmful to Elsevier and much more powerful in the sign that it could state. And since you haven't received any response from this authority, that's basically quite a negative sign, I think.
I mean, you know, I don't want to speculate too much about, you know, why we didn't get a response. It's not like that the issues that we highlighted in the referral were not true. And in fact, you know, this was not the first time that, you know, something like this has happened. So I think back in 2002, the Office for Fair Trading Standards, they actually did a market level investigation into Elsevier and the scholarly publishing market. It was motivated by Elsevier and growing concerns about them. And, you know, they said basically that, you know, things aren't working too well, you know, at the moment. You know, Elsevier have far too much control over the scholarly publishing market. And they said, if things get worse, then we will have to do another formal investigation and maybe take action. Mm-hmm. And that was 16 years ago now, or 14 years before we made this referral. And statistically, no matter how you divvy up the information, Elsevier have, well, the situation with respect to Elsevier has got much worse. Mm-hmm. So, you know, based on their own recommendations, they should, in fact, be investigated again, Elsevier in particular, but the entire publishing market. And, you know, Martin Eve was he was even part of a committee hearing once where he had to provide evidence to the UK government about this sort of thing. And one of the MPs on the committee who was questioning him said, you know, why hasn't anybody referred Elsevier to the UK Markets Authority yet? And Martin simply said, well, I don't know. I wish somebody would, and I wish somebody in government would actually act upon this. And I guess, like, this referral, which was ultimately made, was, you know, finally someone going, okay, fine, we'll do it. You know, we'll finally, you know, put our money where our mouth is. And we didn't hear anything back. So, you know.
Right, on the contrary. I mean, Elsevier has been involved recently in quite important, I would say, maybe in air quotes important, activities on the European level, right? Mm-hmm. And those activities who have been should have been in the favor of progressing open science, namely the open science monitor of the European Commission, that has been published now a couple of months ago, if I remember correctly. And it turns out that the building of this monitor, which is basically looking into metrics in order to trying to grasp and to portray the situation of the open science movement, they have been heavily relying on data that comes directly from Elsevier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This open science monitor, you know, it's basically designed to evaluate the progress of open science in the EU for the next few years, and use that monitor information to alter the course of open science as well as public policy surrounding it. So, you know, the European Commission has been leading on open science policy for the last few years, and now Elsevier, as subcontractor to this open science monitor, are using basically Elsevier only tools and services to track the development of open science. So not only is that a humongous conflict of interest, because by using those services as opposed to any of those from their competitors, they stand to gain a huge amount in terms of usage and finance from that. But then Elsevier are going to be providing the data that's going to dictate public policy in the EU from now on and the future of open science. And, you know, for an organization that has a history of lobbying against open access and doing everything that it can to basically stifle its growth, we should be incredibly suspicious and, you know, angry, in fact, that Elsevier have somehow managed to get them in this position. It's profoundly anti-democratic. Who knows how on earth they managed to get into this sort of position. You know, I should actually have an article coming out in The Guardian, hopefully this week, where I recommend that Elsevier should be evicted from this position and instead having a high-level expert committee comprising of a range of experts from across industry forming an independent group who can basically perform the same job without the inherent conflict of interest and the, you know, encouraging the growth of Elsevier in this space. So,
yeah, I mean, that was blatantly a really stupid move of the European Commission, and they have been known for kind of providing experts that turned out to be either flawed by one side or no experts at all. But this is so obvious to actually take one of the main, I wouldn't say opponents, but of the main traditional publishing houses to provide data in something that is built in order to give guidance to how to strategically direct open science in the European community is just stupid, I think. Or something that is really that states how much of worth open science actually is to the European Communion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have thoughts, speculative thoughts on why this might be. So, you know, there's a website out there which tracks basically lobbying in the EU, and Elsevier have 6 lobbyists who basically sit in Parliament. Sit within the European Commission grounds. 3 of which actually have direct access to the European Parliament. Hmm. And I suspect that they lobby pretty heavy for Elsevier to get this contract. There's no reason why they shouldn't. Like, that is their sole purpose. And, you know, with this this trend, the way things are going, like, the European Commission are also building this open access platform now. And it seems likely that Elsevier will be one of the top runners to get that, in which case we'll have Elsevier having even more control over open access publishing infrastructure within the EU. It's crazy. So,
yeah.
And it doesn't stop there, right? I mean, we also have the announcement of the open access platform for Europe. And this is, by the way, the last time we stumbled across Martin Eve, because he had a blog post about the specification of that platform that was basically announced, where there was a call for that. And even there, the question is, can, for example, Elsevier apply for that? And that would be a similar bad thing as as for that monitor, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure Elsevier have applied, along with others. So, you know, others like, you know, F1000 definitely in the running for that. That would definitely be the lesser of many evils. You know, they're a, you know, a good publisher, I guess, despite being privately owned. But yeah, you know, just having Elsevier, you know, I care less about them being the publisher, but the control in which it grants them over this sort of this process, you know, like I said, they have this incredible history of being anti-open, and, you know, having them dominating this open space, yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. So that's my major concern. And in fact, you know, that if Elsevier are in control of openness rather than the scholarly research community themselves, then we failed, because that's not really openness at all.
And I think quite a number of people have taken up this issue and addressed it more or less openly, also towards representatives of the European Union. But at least I don't have anything on my radar that comes close to some kind of answer or response to those addresses. Did you guys hear anything?
Not just yet. So like, I think with the Open Science Monitor, there is actually a way to formally appeal, but I have to look into that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Okay, but yeah, exactly. But you are still not only a fighter of open science, but you're still kind of deeply attached to your core field of, you're still a paleo, basically, right? Mm-hmm. And you want to spread knowledge about this even to the youngest. And So you wrote a small book about this. Maybe we can have a short look at this, actually.
Sure. Yeah.
Sorry for pulling this out.
It's a nice break for the audience as well. Move from Elsevier to dinosaurs.
Exactly, to something cool again. Yeah.
Yeah, so, oh, goodness. Yeah, it's a kid's book about dinosaurs, called Excavate Dinosaurs. I finished it, I think, back in 2013 now. And it's available in 12 different languages, which is fantastic. You know, it's in German, and I still can't read it because my German's terrible. but I still have a laugh at the word Schwanz for obvious reasons. it's got, like, pop-out... The idea is that... you know, you go through the book and you read all of these facts about different dinosaurs. And then when you get to the back, it's like a fossil graveyard with loads of jumbled up bones that you can pop out. They're made of cardboard. And then you have to use the details in the book to reconstruct models of dinosaurs. So, you know, the idea is that you become a paleontologist in the process. So I like it. It's got a lot of good feedback so far. I don't get any royalties from it, so I'm happy to advertise it.
Sounds good.
Is that something that you want to look into further? I mean, some kind of in research communication or science communication in the widest sense, in the broadest sense, has always been on your agenda, I think, in more or less all of the activities that you're doing. But kids' education, as playful as it can be, is something that not many scientists look into. But I think it's something that actually has a lot of sense and that probably gets some or pays then back a while later when they get to university level or whatever it is. So yeah. do you want to follow that up with something, or was that a one-time opportunity?
I mean, like, yeah, so paleontology is, it's a fairly unique subject, right? You know, we don't exactly have an impact on the economy apart from, like, through museums or public policy or society.
Movies.
It doesn't have that much of an impact. People can say, you know, with cancer research, how does paleontology fit in with comparison to that? It's not going to save anybody's life. I think in our field, though, you know, the biggest impact that we have is inspiration. You know, kids love dinosaurs. You know, every time you go to a museum, the first thing you'll do is you'll see swarms of kids rushing towards the dinosaurs to become inspired and to learn more about these things. And through that sort of inspiration for history, for science, they can hopefully go on to, you know, be inspired in other scientific domains too and really, you know, want to discover more about, like, the world. So, you know, I feel like paleontology is like a gateway science, and therefore we sort of owe it to the public and to the wider community, to society, to communicate our research more. That's basically it. And, like, you know, if we're not engaging the public with our science, then really why are we doing it? You know, that's like this ivory tower mindset, which is slowly going away. But yeah, science communication, you know, if science hasn't been communicated, then what's the point in doing it, right? We should be, you know, paying our dues to the public who fund us as well, for starters. That's about it.
I didn't know that it's available in German, so I think I will get one for my kids now.
Ah, okay. Yeah, you can get it from the museum. Awesome. The condo.
Nice.
Every now and then I sneakily go in and sign it.
Awesome.
Copy. So.
Great. Okay, but one of your bigger projects that you are doing right now is the Open Science MOOC. And this is something I think I've heard the first time of in the BarCamp, in the Open Science BarCamp 2017. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit what is this all about and what's the current status and what are the developments there?
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Yeah, so for those listeners who don't know what a MOOC is, MOOC stands for Massively Open Online Course. And it's essentially like an educational or training platform, and in this case for open science. So it all began with a stupid tweet of mine. I was in Vietnam with my girlfriend who also works in open science, and we were just walking down the street, and I said, you know, who's actually doing like open science training? You know, it's growing in popularity. People are calling for it all the time, but you know, who's actually training, you know, students and grad students and undergrads and early career researchers in how to do this these broad practices, which we sort of label as open science. So I tweeted out to the world saying, you know, is it about time that we built an open science training platform like a MOOC? And the response was overwhelmingly positive. And most of them said, yes, you should totally go and do that. So I was like, oh, crap. I sort of dubbed myself in there. Mm-hmm. And then, when we got back to Europe a few months later, or 6 months later, I decided to sort of make it formal. So I reached out to a bunch of experts who I know to build a steering committee around this. We created a website, and we started looking into like the structure of how it would work. You know, what would the curriculum be like? What would the resources we use be? And it's been very slow progress, honestly, for the last 6-7 months or so, because it's volunteer led, and I really, you know, I've been running it like basically in my spare time while trying to work on all these other projects and things. But now, you know, it's taking off. We're developing content. We're in communication with various organizations about how to host it and how to deliver the program through graduate schools in the EU to begin with. There's some absolutely phenomenal people who I'm working on this with who are really helping to make it happen. We have partnerships with about 40 open-minded organizations out there to provide support and communication when it's ready. It's beginning to come together very slowly. So, yay. You know, one of the main catalysts for it was, you know, not just this demand from the researcher side of things, but around the mid of 2017, the European Commission, they published several high-level reports again saying, you know, we need to develop more open science skills and training and education services and platforms for our researchers. But they never really specified how to do this. You know, they were saying, you know, this is what we want. You know, the future of science in the EU is open, but we're not going to teach people how to actually do this. So I saw, you know, basically a gap in which needed filling, and I was like, okay, let's try and fill that gap, and let's try and, you know, at the same time, you know, make science better, like make it more reliable, more reproducible, more open. So that was sort of like how it came about to the present state.
Mm-hmm. And currently, it has basically 10 different modules, and mm-hmm. I guess this is also fixed like this. I mean, the process of getting there was rather interesting, because you basically started a Google Doc and let people contribute to that, right? So also the process of getting there was rather open. And by this, you came to the 10 modules. I guess this will also remain for the time being, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and,
No, please go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, like, you know, we wanted the whole project to be based on open principles. So yeah, that's why we started this Google Doc. You know, I don't want to be in a position where I'm trying to dictate the future of open science. Like, that's not a sort of responsibility I want or deserve in any way. And I was like, look, you know, it should be the community who's deciding this. And we had hundreds and hundreds of people who end up contributing to this initial framework and strategy and, you know, defining what these 10 modules were. And it was fantastic. Like, you know, people would come in and discuss whether it should be, you know, should it be citizen science? Should it be public engagement in science? Should it be public engagement in science communication or public outreach in science communication? You know, what should the content of the curriculum be? What should the objectives of each module be? And, you know, by having it open like this, it really feels like it has this community-based values in it, and therefore, you know, a reason for the wider community to hopefully engage with it once it's complete. And it just sort of made sense to me. Like, there was no point for me to come in and say, look, these are the 10 most important aspects of open science, and this is what you're going to learn. It should be something which the community themselves feel like they have had a part in constructing. Just because, you know, it shows where the true value to me lies, which is the community, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And yeah, we recently migrated the whole website recently to make it open source as well. So originally the main companion website had been built on WordPress, which wasn't particularly open. So we recently migrated it to Git Pages. Special thanks to Kevin Moorman from MIT for doing that. Yeah, he was instrumental in getting this set up. So thank you, Kevin, if you're listening.
And by that, you also basically bring it to a different level, because now it's kind of, as it's on GitHub, you can put issues there and so on. So basically you can make the development even more open and accessible by others. And what is basically the state now? I mean, what is missing? Do you need inputs? Do you need people working on a dedicated topic? Or what is the working mode right now?
So at the moment, what we're doing is we're building a pilot module sort of to test. So what we have is like a production protocol to make sure that everything is standardized and formalized and easy to trace and easy to develop in the first place. And what we're doing is we're building the open source module. So it's module 5 at the moment, and we have a bunch of awesome people working on that. And the idea is to build this pilot module and then send it out for testing and receive feedback, use that to refine the protocol and the content, and then start building the other modules after we've sort of like refined the process. At the moment, we're still in the very early stages of development for this. But yeah, like you mentioned, most of it's happening on GitHub. You know, I realize that GitHub can be fairly difficult for some people and fairly off-putting. But it's much better than working in a Google Doc, because we can track people's contributions. You know, people can submit issues, like you said, and that's where a lot of these things are coming in. Like, people are like, hey, you know, make sure to include like these aspects when you're developing this part of the curriculum. And it makes it much easier to do as a process. It's much cleaner, I guess, and easier for people to contribute. The fear that a lot of people have with GitHub, I understand fully as well, because I didn't understand it either until I started like actually building content for the MOOC. And I was like, look, you know, if we're going to be teaching researchers how to use GitHub as part of like an open research workflow, I should really learn how to use GitHub. And once I got over like the slight technical and language barriers, it was like, ooh, you know, this is magical. And, you know, because it was a bit more difficult for me to learn, it just made the payoff even more valuable. It's the same as learning in any aspect of what we do. You know, the more difficult it is to achieve something, the more value that it inherently ends up having a lot of the time. So hopefully people will, you know, who end up contributing to the MOOC also learn a new skill in learning how to work openly as well at the same time. But yeah, the current state is that we're still developing, still in the very early phases. If people do want to get involved, like you said, it's all on GitHub, open to anyone to contribute anything which they want. Hopefully, like, it's fairly easy to follow the contribution guidelines and the production guidelines. We don't want to discriminate against anyone either. So all people need to do if they want to contribute is contribute. Easy to say.
In this whole process, which is kind of having grown into something rather big, measured along the lines of how many people actually have contributed or are contributing, what would you think are the big challenges here? Is it just merely kind of getting all the people thinking into a similar direction, or is it certain points of how to establish things, or
It's different depending on the different aspects of the project. So, like, the initial foundations document, it was beautiful to see because people would just come in, contribute, like, their little bit of expertise, and then leave. That was basically it. And if they wanted to receive credit for it, they could just put their name down. We made it very easy for people to do so. Now that we've come to, like, the content development stage, the way in which we're doing it is having, like, a core development team for each module. For the open source one at the moment, this involves 6 people who have signed up as well. And we're reaching out to a few more people from, for example, the software carpentry group very soon. So the management of the people has been relatively easy, actually, because there's been so much desire to contribute. It's simply just been a case of, like, channeling that. One of the more difficult aspects of it so far has definitely been deciding on how to implement it. So because this is basically a volunteer-led project, it makes decisions around the final hosting platform and services and how to deliver it in a formalized way into grad schools so that it becomes like a recognizable, certified part of grad school training programs. That's been like the difficult part so far. And we're still actually working on that at the moment. It looks like we're going to be using, a number of instances of OpenEdX, which are hosted by organizations and individuals who are really keen on helping with delivery with this and get that out there. But yeah, finding time to do content creation as well is difficult. Thankfully, recently, I received a small grant from the Shuttleworth Foundation to help sort of like accelerate the content development. And I'll be using that over the next few months to really, hit the grindstone and I want to finish this pilot module within the next couple of months at least and get it out there so that we can begin working on the other ones as well. So, there's never enough time. That's probably the biggest issue.
I think that's one of the topics that comes into mind if there's something like grants out there that are worth applying for. But then again, this is probably then also a process in itself to actually write a grant application, to submit it. Then you have a time frame for evaluation. Then you have the grant only running for a certain amount of time. It might not be enough to fully cover all the costs and people involved. And then you have afterwards, especially, you have the problem of, or the challenge to find something to put the whole thing that you have developed with the grant money onto something, onto a basis that allows us to further exist and to further develop itself, right?
Yeah. So sustainability is always a key issue. Yeah. I can't just build it and then leave it in some ways. So, By having like this community involvement, hopefully we can sustain, we can make it more sustainable in the future. We really haven't applied for any grants yet either because, like you said, it's very time consuming. And I really want to make sure that we actually have like a sort of like initial, this first module before we seek extra funding. Because for the last year or so, it's been a self-funded project. I do all these other freelance things on the side and that's what sustained it up until this point. But that's not a sustainable funding approach in itself. So this is definitely something that we have to work out in the future. But thankfully, with organizations like Shuttleworth out there recognizing the value in projects like this, then you never know, we could be lucky. So.
Yeah. Great. So it will be really interesting to see what the first pilot module looks like, because in the recent month and probably 1 or 2 years even, we have seen quite a bit of training efforts popping up here and there. Just recently, and we already spoke about this, the Foster Open Science Training that is based on a book that was written in a book sprint. I think you even have participated, right?
Yep, I was part of that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah, we actually used the MOOC framework, like this modular framework, to structure the book, to structure a lot of the book in the end, because rather than trying to recreate an open science taxonomy or whatever, it was easier to use an existing one and then link them together. Saved a lot of time and effort.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Foster, there is an increase in and interest around this. But in my experience and speaking with a lot of people who are leading these trainings, it's a very fragmented landscape. So, you know, a training can be, you know, just it can take like a week to organize a 2-day workshop or something in a particular university where you get 30 people to turn up and they leave with some skills. Like, the intention behind the MOOC is to sort of not only just bring all of these things together, but I want 50,000 people doing it like every month and you know, not having it so constrained by, you know, the physical requirements behind, you know, an in-person training, but to really scale up these efforts, bring them together, and, you know, accelerate open science and the training behind it. So, yeah.
I mean, it could be to do it on a larger scale is probably something that is also contributing to the quality of the program itself. Because once you have a broader audience coming from various cultural backgrounds, from various academic backgrounds, from various contextual backgrounds, like you're coming from paleontology, somebody's coming from biology, and other people are coming from the digital humanities. This probably, in the discussions that these people have, this has a certain value in itself, and probably is also by providing feedback to you or somebody who's writing on the content, it could also be beneficial.
Yeah, so this was something that we were very much aware of, like right from the beginning, like the fact that, you know, open science in itself is a very heterogeneous term, and it's understood in many different ways across many different communities. And so the MOOC will not be, and I never intended to be, like this sort of one size fits all solution where you know, it was tailored specifically for the biosciences or for the digital humanities or something like that. But what we intend for it to be is like a place where you can go to learn best practices in certain subdomains of open science, understand what different communities are doing, and then maybe use that to reflect on some of the practices within your own community. And, you know, we don't want to be exclusive. Like, you know, one of the principles of open to me has always been inclusivity. And that's why actually calling it like the Open Science MOOC rather than like the Open Scholarship MOOC was a difficult sort of decision, because, you know, a lot of people will say, well, you know, I'm not a scientist, therefore should I be doing open science? And really it was like a tactical marketing decision in the end, the fact that more people understand what open science is rather than open research or open scholarship. But, you know, we want to, we accept the risk, you know, that for some disciplines, this sort of strategy of providing just best practices might not work for everyone. And, you know, one of the reasons why we are building it in the open as well is that, you know, for communities who might not feel like this appeals to them, they can still sort of like take the content or take the structure and reuse it and create their own tailored versions of these modules for their own communities. You know, the principles of reuse and promote inclusivity in this case. But yeah, it's something which we've definitely been very much aware of, like right from the beginning of this. Yeah. It's difficult to resolve as well, you know.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be also interesting if this, you know, if this could be seen as kind of a crystallization point for many other endeavors. As you said, the whole community is rather scattered regarding these kind of things, and maybe this is could be kind of a core theme, because these modules represent, well, kind of independent principles, but they could then be refined depending on the different domains. So maybe people see that this is a good starting point for basically setting the foundations, and then say, okay, now you know all the core principles. Here in life science, it looks like this. And here in, I don't know, in the geosciences, it looks like that. So this might be a cool thing that maybe in the future develops even in something like a hub for these kind of things. This would be something pretty cool. And actually having you on board there, or having you there as the driving force there, I could even imagine that this works out, because you are very well connected and know several people who are in this domain. So I want to put too much pressure on your shoulders. I know you're doing this inside project, but a lot of people are looking at this, and I'm pretty sure that this will fly high.
Yeah, I would absolutely love that. You know, if different communities found ways of adapting it to different selves, or it became like a hub. So, you know, one of the things which I did, like very early on with this, was I built this, amassed this humongous open science resource list. It's available on the website already, broken down by submodule. And you know, what we found was that a lot of sort of training resources already exist. So one of the modules, for example, is reproducible research. And there are about seven different sort of like workshop resources which already exist trying to teach researchers how to be more reproducible about their work. And often these are tailored at different communities and therefore very specific, but there are general parts of it which are common amongst all bits, which we can take and adapt in different ways and, like, you know, combine with other resources out there to create like a more holistic sort of module here that will be more suitable for wider audiences. And again, that can then go on and be tailored for the different communities. But yeah, you know, bringing together, you know, this fragmented landscape is certainly something, you know, which we would love to do in the future. And in fact, you know, a lot of the time when I talk to people about, like, you know, where do you see the MOOC in 5 years' time? I say, I don't want it to exist anymore. You know, I want it to be redundant, because by then, like, if everybody is grounded in like these principles of open science and understands it at a very foundational level and has gone on then to develop that into new bespoke tools for their communities, then we're not needed anymore because we've been successful. And then I'll be happy. So
that's what we always say. In 5 years, we don't want to be the open science radio anymore. We want to be just the science radio, because open science is the standard, right? And yep. Then it's obsolete to talk about it.
Yeah, you're right. You know, a lot of the talks and stuff I've given recently have actually been trying to work with people to understand like what open science really is, because, you know, no matter what definition of open, I'm doing air quotes here, which you obviously can't see on radio. No matter what your definition of open science is, to me, it's just like, well, you know, isn't that just good science? You know, we say open science is reproducible and transparent. It means that the public have access to it. It's like, cool. Isn't that just good science? And if you take away those traits, that's not science. It's bad science, right? So that's how I think about it anyway.
Yeah.
So yes, you know, let's stop using the word open science and refer to closed science as bad science and open science as science.
We should try to encode these features, these principles, actually into guidelines for good scientific practices that are around since quite a while, but that are not covering these so far. And once we have this as part of this core foundations that are also taught to everybody, then we're done. So basically, we just need to rebrand this MOOC to maybe good scientific practice MOOC instead of open science MOOC in the near future, and then everything's good. Let's see when we get there. The five years are rather ambitious, but well, we need to have an aim, right?
Yeah, I mean, I love that. Like, as far as I know, like in my field, there are no best practices for data sharing or for code sharing or for publishing or for metrics usage or anything like that. You know, I would love to see the content from the MOOC being used to create, you know, new best practices, where, you know, the foundational principles guiding these are things like transparency, reproducibility, inclusivity, fairness, equality, justice, you know, all of these things which openness is based on. That'd be epic.
Good.
You know, not that we're all overly ambitious or anything.
Just kind of. Okay. Do you have missed anything regarding the MOOC? I guess we can invite people, right? I mean, it's we can advertise it a little bit that people are warmly welcome, I assume, right? And contributing to that, I think you wouldn't mind.
No, I mean, like, we have an open Slack channel where we do most of the communication. There's like 140 people on there already. A lot of things happen, you know, on GitHub as well. You know, transparency, inclusivity is key, right? We don't want to off-put anyone from communicating or getting involved in the process. Yeah, so the more people shout about it, the more people can get involved. The more people get involved, the more diverse viewpoints and things that we have, that improves the quality of what we do. you know, it's openness is the key. That's what we do. So yes, please advertise away.
open on all levels.
Yeah.
have we forgotten anything else that we need to mention here that would be interesting to talk about?
Yeah, definitely. From my point of view, we definitely missed something, which brings us right back to the beginning of this episode. When did you actually come into contact with open access, open science, and what the heck was going on that drove you towards it?
All right. So I know I've rehearsed this story quite a bit. So it was back when I was a master's student in the UK in London. I was doing a master's in biodiversity and taxonomy at Imperial College. And I remember I was in the pub with a paleontology friend of mine who we've already mentioned, Mr. Ross Mounts. And I was speaking to him and I told him, he's like, yeah, you know, I'd really like to try and, you know, publish my master's thesis because it might be really useful in, you know, when I'm applying for PhDs after. And he said to me, he's like, well, are you going to publish your open access? And I was like, what the hell is open access? And he said, you know, it's when everybody in the on the you know, everybody in the world has access to your research rather than just, you know, a few people at rich universities. And I was just like, I was so confused. I was like, wait, but, you know, don't people have access to things anyway? And like, you know, my privilege, I guess, just sort of unraveled in front of me. And, you know, the fact that I could access research because I was at Imperial and previous to that I was at Manchester University. But, you know, what about those people who aren't fortunate enough? What about the people who do want to read this work but don't have that sort of that status or privilege? You know, how do we make that work open to them? And it just made sense to me. And the more I thought about it, the crazier it became. You know, I remembered, like, when I was doing research for my first master's at Manchester, I remember hitting paywalls all the time and just thinking that it was a regular thing. It was like, okay, well, I can't read this paper. Let me just find one which I do have access to and cite that one instead, which is terrible, right? You know, we shouldn't be doing research like that. And yeah, it wasn't great, you know. And yeah, like I said, like everything sort of unraveled in front of me, and open access just made sense. Like it aligned with my own personal values about, you know, freedom of information and freedom to access knowledge and all of this stuff, fairness and equality and justice. You know, these are principles which I have as a human and which I believe most researchers do too. And open access just made sense. And the more I learned about it, the crazier things became, you know, like the cost of subscriptions, the cost of open access, you know, publishers and their abuse of copyright, publishers and lobbying, you know, oh, just all of it just became like a mess. How research is evaluated based on publication rather than anything to do with the inherent quality of research, you know, the discrimination and stuff within the academy based on this. And the more I learned, the more I wanted to change things. And that was seven years ago now, I think, when I remember having that conversation with Ross. And since then, you know, I've been fighting for openness every day in various aspects of research. So that was it. Thanks, Ross.
Awesome.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, it was this one-on-one story. Like everyone has their own reason for getting into this. In fact, you know, what are the reasons for you two?
Matthias.
I think I stumbled upon something else. When I was working in the academic world, I would say, I was working for one of the big German applied science research communities or organizations, rather, Fraunhofer back then. And I stumbled upon something that I thought is inherent in science, and that was the experiment. So I had kind of, maybe not ideas of my own, but kind of ideas of science communication that were a bit more hands-on, a bit more directed towards putting also the researcher into the perspective and giving a bit more transparent insight into why people actually work in the system, how they work in the system, what they actually do their whole day. And of course, I now get it that there is something that you don't want to necessarily reveal, because a lot of the work has to do with formalities and bringing down obstacles and all these kind of things. But there's still enough interesting facts going on and a lot of interesting stories. And I was always withheld somehow with the argument that this won't work and people are not interested. And my argumentation was always, why? Just let's try it. I mean, let's try it. And if it turns out to be a bad idea, let's discontinue it again, right? And nobody or hardly anybody was willing to go down that trial and error route, because everybody was afraid of the error component, of admitting failure, of maybe running into failure, and maybe coming into the pressure, into the situation where they have to argue why they have tried something that has failed in the ultimate end, and why did they have spent money on this and basically burnt the money. And I couldn't understand why this working ethos of experimenting that is so tried and tested and inherent into science wasn't working for the activities that I was doing there and the work that I was tasked with. And I started looking left and right and what's going on in science, and then somehow I stumbled upon the open science in terms of open methods and sharing your results, no matter whether they are positive or negative, and sharing your methods and showing that you have maybe also needed a couple of rounds in order to perfect your method, but not only sharing the perfected method, but also all these stages beforehand that basically show other people what were the wrong approaches that you have taken. And this is how I kind of started looking into the whole open science. And when I then switched jobs, open access became way more important for me, because I was relying heavily on scientific input on my kind of topics, because I wanted to have a theoretical foundation that was solid. So I needed to look into theory and into science. And of course, I was outside of any institutions that have access to most of the paid journals. So there was hardly anything else I could do than looking into open science journeys. Of course, now I could sci-hub.
Don't use sci-hub.
Right. Anyway.
Who would do that?
So openly available research results and articles have been increasingly important for me over the last 5 years working in the industry, not merely working in the academic world anymore. And that's how something I grew fond of the thought that this might be something that is more important than securing your next grant.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's amazing, isn't it? What happens when you have like your privilege stripped away from you?
Yeah, right.
And you realize, you know, it's like, oh crap. That's what open access was all about.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And for me, it was different, actually rather different path, because for me, it was more I was socialized in the open source world. So when I started using Linux and all the different open source tools that you like to play around with as a student and try to explore that universe. And if you are then bound to this community around this chaos communication camps and the communication chaos communication congresses, and then the club itself, the chaos computer club, and so on, and different communities, I was linked to the open BSD developers and was somehow in there and so on. So with this kind of moral foundation, entering then a PhD and seeing that stuff works differently, and at the same time this Web 2.0 hit also science, and we found new channels to discuss these kind of topics, you bumped into different information and found more and more people thinking loudly how crazy that system is, and that it's kind of absurd that we are what we're doing there, let's say in general, without pointing to different things like publishing and so on. And with this foundation and that view, a lot of things look very, very bad in science. And luckily you find then other people who think the same, and well, suddenly you're inside the pot of open science promoters and trying to do this yourself in a way. While still trying to survive in that scientific system, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So it's the balance, right?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Good. Yeah, that was fun. Have you missed anything else? Not that we have a big to-do list here to fulfill, but I guess we've covered a lot, mm-hmm. and we know afterwards we think we should have done this as well. But on the other hand, I'm pretty sure this won't be the last time. I mean, we'll bump into each other very often, mm-hmm. different meetings and conferences. So in case we missed a big thing or the next big thing from your side is coming up at some point, we will clearly put you again in front of Mick and a mic and talk with you again, I would say.
I don't think we should subject
to it. So thanks for your time, John. And we know you're a busy man. And I think everybody knows that after listening to this now as well.
Well, thank you both so much. Like, it was great hearing both your stories as well. So, I feel like we should do more of that. Share the reasons and the motivations why it is that we do what we do. About how you overcome like this fear and the risk associated with being open based on, core principles and motivations. I think that's important. It was great to hear from both of you. That at the end. So very inspiring. Cool.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
And I assume we just briefly mentioned this in a side sentence, but as John said, he has given quite a number of talks by now, and I would strongly suggest if you're looking for somebody who's giving your audience, whoever that might be, either a training or a talk, I think John is a very valuable option to go to. And if you want to have an impression, I just recently watched your talk in the open air context, something like a keynote you gave. That was really
enjoyable. The Doria one in Paris.
Yeah, you used that penguin stuff again.
Yeah.
I love it. So I will link that talk in the show notes and strongly suggest that you have a look at it because it's really good. And I assume that you're willing to do more of these things, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty pumped up until the end of the year.
This does.
I'm happy to talk about it.
This doesn't sound convincing.
But I'm getting a little bit sick of my own voice though now. So, often, in fact, often the way which I think about these things is I give a lot of talks and, I'm a pretty generic, privileged dude. So half the time now I will recommend people whose voice is not as, common as mine to give their perspectives instead. Particularly, there are so many people working in this field from, the global south or from a minority representation. And so if you do want to invite me, have a look and make sure if there are other people who might need a voice amplification first rather than mine, because I've done this enough now. And
or
I'm sick and tired of my own voice.
Yeah. Or ask you if you have some recommendation.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I oh my goodness. I have thousands from all around the world. But thank you. That was very kind.
Great. So let's wrap this up. Thanks, John, for joining us.
Thank you both so much as well. It's been great. So.
I'm sure we meet somewhere. If you guys have questions, have opinions of your own, put them into the comment. Let us know what you think. And I'm sure that we will be back with another episode soon.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
All right. Thanks, guys. And ciao for now.
Ciao.
Yep. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.